Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Myers, There Are Ways Bars Can Reopen Safely, by Stuart Doreen. There are ways bars can open safely if the governor chooses to reopen them, according to Midland Health CEO Russell Myers. Myers said social distancing rules, similar to those restaurants must follow, could be implemented. Whether patrons choose to follow those rules is another matter, he said. Governor Greg Abbott said last month that bars could potentially reopen once coronavirus metrics improve more significantly. But he said he would need to see the state's positivity rate drop below 10% for a sustained period of time and for hospitalizations to decrease, according to an article from the Texas Tribune. Myers said Tuesday that the number of people testing positive during Midland Health testing was below 10% for two straight weeks. He said that more than 400 people had been tested each week, and those people exhibited symptoms or had been determined to have been exposed to someone who tested positive for coronavirus. Myers said that the same type of things being done in restaurants certainly can be done in bars, but the challenge has been when a person consumes alcoholic beverages and their inhibitions and compliance with those kinds of rules tends to be reduced. So it actually makes it less likely that people will follow the rules once they get a drink or two in them, Myers said. I'm glad that I'm not in the governor's shoes and having to make those decisions. Myers said Abbott wants the economy to continue to reopen while still taking into consideration the health of the community. As the numbers go down, I know the governor is going to have to consider that, Myers said. Whether it can be done safely or not, I think is somewhat in question. But there are ways that it can be done, and I would hope that those are considered. New rules approved by the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission in late August eliminated requirements that prevented many bars from reopening under Abbott's COVID-19 restrictions, according to a story in the Austin American-Statesman. The rules lifted the requirement for an on-site kitchen and let bars count the sale from prepackaged food and food trucks as food revenue. The idea is to help bars raise their total revenue from food above 51%, which is the threshold needed to qualify for a food and beverage permit. This article is entitled DPS Trooper Ready to Fill Leadership Void in District 4 by Stuart Doreen. A Texas Department of Public Safety trooper with four children in Midland ISD and questions about district leadership is the third candidate in the race to represent the city's center. Steve Vargas seeks to represent District 4, which starts in central Midland near Bowie Fine Arts Academy and works its way across the city, picking up neighborhoods around Sam Houston Collegiate Preparatory Academy, Midland Alternative Program, Lamar Elementary, Long Elementary, Burnett Elementary, and then works its way into southwest Midland and into the county. John Kennedy, the current representative, is not seeking re-election. Challenging Vargas will be Katie Joyner and Joel Deal. Vargas boasts experience in the Marines, the oil field, and regional law enforcement. His wife is a native Midlander. Two of their children are part of Midland ISD's life skills classes, and it has been the district's performance that opened his eyes. Following the life skills program, I have seen the steep decline to where we are now, Vargas said, adding that writing letters and voicing his concerns will get a person only so far. After seeing no change, it was time to stop voicing my opinion, but try to get in there and get the district pointed in a better direction. The foundation is there, but leadership needs to give kids the best opportunity to succeed. Leadership, from the superintendent's office on down to campuses and in classrooms, is what he believes will fix an ailing district. He believes that reform is necessary. He says the issues are systemic. He claims the lack of accountability is making policies useless. It is impossible to look for leadership characteristics when the board does not possess it themselves, Vargas said. The school board has the power within the budget to hold the superintendent accountable if need be.
Once we address leadership issue, that will help with academic issues that many face now. Vargas said that in order to instill confidence in teachers and students, the district must give teachers their voice back. And then central office must create a better reporting pipeline to make sure teachers' concerns are being heard and responded to in a timely manner. Teachers are the ones in the classroom. They are the ones building up relationships with students. They know what method of learning and what learning plan is best for each student. And they are the ones who ultimately we should give control back to, Vargas said. His concerns include taking care of the essentials, providing clean water, maintaining facilities, and improving security on campuses across the district. He said issues like these have become burdens facing the schools, and those issues are taking precious time, resources, and attention from what is happening in the classroom. The DPS trooper discussed the safety element and the fight culture that, when students have been on campus, makes the school day more treacherous. He questioned the lack of action and commented on why other counties aren't seeing the level of fighting that he said takes place within MISD. Why is that? Vargas said. We can implement programs so teachers can step in and hold these people accountable. We can give them the training they need to address those issues. There are other solutions outside of policing. This article is entitled Trinity Has National Merit Semifinalists by Stuart Doreen. Editor's note, the Reporter-Telegram will profile Bryden in an upcoming edition. A Trinity School senior is a semifinalist in the 66th Annual National Merit Scholarship Program. Danielle E. Bryden was the lone Midland County student to make the National Merit Scholarship Corporation's prestigious list this year. Last year, two Midland County students, Hayden Hamm of Lee High School and Christian Bell of Greenwood High School, landed spots on the semifinal list. National Merit Scholarship Corporation reported this week there were 16,000 semifinalists across the nation. It also reported more than 1.5 million juniors in about 21,000 high schools entered the 2021 National Merit Scholarship Program by taking the 2019 preliminary SAT National Merit Scholarship Qualifying Test, which served as an initial screen of program entrance. The nationwide pool of semifinalists represents less than 1% of U.S. high school seniors, includes the highest scoring entrants in each state. More than 90% of semifinalists are expected to attain finalist standing, and more than half of the finalists will win a National Merit Scholarship, earning the Merit Scholar title, according to the corporation. Over the last 10 years, an average of 2.2 students from Midland County earned the National Merit Semifinalist status. This marked the second time in 3 years that Midland ISD didn't have a semifinalist. Reporter-Telegram records show that between 2002 and 2007, that average number of semifinalists from Midland County was greater than 10 students a year. A list of semifinalists statewide shows that the school districts and private schools inside the cities of Odessa and San Angelo were shut out this year. While there were two from inside the city of Lubbock, one from Wolfirth, four from Amarillo, all Amarillo High students, and one from Abilene. A look at the list shows larger population metropolitan areas dominated the list. For instance, seven high schools inside Katy combined for more than 80, and six high schools inside Plano combined for more than 100. This is the local and COVID-19 page. This article is entitled Coronavirus Cases Start the Week Trending Lower by Stuart Doreen. There were 47 new coronavirus cases from tests taken Saturday through Tuesday, according to the Midland Health Department. The 47 cases raised the total during the pandemic above the 3,400 mark, but the total shows the downward trend continues inside Midland County. Last week, Midland Health Department officials reported a combined 60 cases on Monday and Tuesday. That means the total Tuesday is 13 fewer, and that this week is off to a better start than last week when the number of cases dropped to the lowest total since mid-June. The total number of cases during the pandemic is at 3,409. The health department also reported 1,260 active cases, 75 fewer than the number reported at the end of last week. There were also 1,897 recovered, 121 more. There have been 74 deaths, which includes the one reported Tuesday, according to the city. Not only were there fewer cases, but hospital officials reported Tuesday that the percentage of people testing positive has been below 10% the past 2 weeks. City, number of COVID-related deaths reaches 74. The city of Midland had its first report of a coronavirus-related death in nearly a week. The city on Tuesday reported the death of a male in his 60s. He died Thursday. He was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital and had underlying health conditions. He was the 74th Midland County resident to die of COVID-19-related issues during the pandemic. Last week, there were 6 deaths. This article is entitled Midland ISD, 4 New Fasken Cases Reported in Last Week by Stuart Doreen. 4 Fasken Elementary staff members were among the 10 coronavirus cases Midland ISD reported last week, according to the district. 2 Fasken teachers reported confirmed coronavirus cases on September 2nd, while another 2 reported cases on Friday, according to the district on its website. 6 Fasken staff members have reported confirmed cases since August 24th. None of the other 6 cases reported last week were from the same campus. Midland ISD reported positive cases at Lee High School Friday, San Jacinto Junior High Friday, Midland High Friday, Lee Freshman High School September 2nd, Goddard Junior High September 2nd, and Alamo Junior High September 1st. The district also reported that no campuses were closed last week. The number of reported cases inside Midland ISD jumped to 64 during the pandemic. A little more than half of those, 33 confirmed cases, have occurred since August 1st. Midland ISD has said that each notification triggers a series of steps, which include sanitizing and disinfecting, notification of individuals in close proximity, and notification to the health department. Anytime we become aware of an individual with a confirmed case who is present at a public gathering, such as a board meeting or sporting event, we will also issue a press release.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, September 9, 2020. Chamber honoree. Hinson receives Chamber's Win Award. The Midland Chamber of Commerce honored Douglas B. Hinson with the Marvin L. Win Award last week at the Chamber's annual meeting. Hinson was part of the Economic Development Department of First National Bank. In his role at the bank, Hinson, a certified industrial developer, was involved in multiple local development projects, including managing the bank's small business lending program to help new entrepreneurs start and grow many businesses. Hinson also was at the center of many bank initiatives, including expansion of the bank tower from 8 to 24 hours, development of the Midland Hilton Hotel on the site of the old Scarborough Hotel, revitalizing Main Street between Wall Street to Illinois Avenue, and putting together the so-called Superblock property that still exists in part, from Big Spring Street to Lorraine Street, between Missouri Avenue and Front Street. Hinson also was involved in other economic development activity from the late 1960s into the 1980s. After leaving First National Bank of Midland, he was a partner with Scarborough Family Members and SBC Corps, and the planning and ultimate build-out of Grassland Estates, Grand Ridge, and major commercial areas anchored by Lowe's, HEB, Scarborough Sports Complex, Crestview Baptist Church, Chevron, Oxy, and DOG. Hinson also served multiple times on the board of directors of the Midland Chamber of Commerce, served as president of the Texas Industrial Development Council, was a longtime leader of the Southern Industrial Development Council, and graduated from the 3-year Economic Development Institute at the University of Oklahoma. Source: Midland Chamber of Commerce. Marvin Wynn Award Winners. 2017, Marvin Wynn, given posthumously. 2018, James Alsup. 2019, Grant Billingsley. 2020, Douglas Hinson. Junior Achievement needs virtual volunteers. These select area volunteer opportunities and events are provided by MSS Connections, a program of MSS made possible by the Warren Charitable Foundation. For more information, visit mssconnections.org. Junior Achievement is looking for virtual volunteers. JA will provide the tools, training, and connection with teachers and support. Contact Shelley Rawson at 682-4966 or SRAWSON at japermianbasin.org. Gifts of Hope needs volunteers for the 14th Annual Victory Run and Walk, which benefits cancer patients. The event is September 19 and is part of the Midland Rockhounds Cancer Awareness Weekend. Contact Rachel D. Leonardo at 520-2255 or RDILEONARDO at MidlandRockhounds.org. Hispanic Cultural Center of Midland needs volunteers for President's Cup Golf Tournament, which is September 26. Help is needed with setting up and taking down, registration, serving breakfast, setting up for lunch, and handing out waters. Volunteers will get breakfast and lunch. Contact Charlene Romero McBride at 683-4226 or hispanicculturalcenter@gmail.com. Be the Change Permian Basin is looking for volunteers for fundraising and their programs, Challenge Day, and BTC Leads. Contact Donnie Don Juan at 685-0449 or donjuan@btcpb.org. Gas prices fall 5 cents in past week. Midland Odessa gas prices have fallen 5.5 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $2.03 a gallon on Monday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 156 stations. Gas prices in Midland Odessa are 7.2 cents per gallon higher than a month ago and stand 43.8 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The following are gasoline prices in Midland Odessa for September 8, going back 10 years. 2019, $2.47 a gallon. 2018, $2.99 a gallon. 2017, $2.54 a gallon. 2016, $1.99 a gallon. 2015, $2.14 a gallon. 2014, $3.22 a gallon. 2013, $3.39 a gallon. 2012, $3.69 a gallon. 2011, $3.56 a gallon. 2010, $2.62 a gallon. Source, Gas Buddy. Health Department is providing services. The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. In addition, the Health Department will have immunization clinics 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday and 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. September 21. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613. Today in History. Today's Wednesday, September 9, the 253rd day of 2020. There are 113 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On September 9, 1776, the Second Continental Congress made the term United States official, replacing United Colonies. On this date, in 1543, Mary Stuart was crowned Queen of Scots at Stirling Castle, 9 months after she was born. In 1850, California became the 31st state of the Union. In 1942, during World War II, a Japanese plane launched from a submarine off the Oregon coast dropped a pair of incendiary bombs in a failed attempt at igniting a massive forest fire. It was the first aerial bombing of the U.S. mainland by a foreign power. In 1948, the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, North Korea, was declared. In 1956, Elvis Presley made the first of three appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show. In 1971, prisoners seized control of the maximum security Attica Correctional Facility near Buffalo, New York, beginning a siege that ended up claiming 43 lives. In 1986, Frank Reed, director of a private school in Lebanon, was taken hostage. He was released 44 months later. In 1991, boxer Mike Tyson was indicted in Indianapolis on a charge of raping Desiree Washington, a beauty pageant contestant. Tyson was convicted and ended up serving 3 years of a 6-year prison sentence. In 2014, Apple unveiled its long-anticipated smartwatch, as well as the next generation of its iPhone. In 2016, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, speaking at an LGBT fundraiser in New York City, described half of Republican Donald Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables, a characterization for which she would end up expressing regret. Today's birthdays: College Football Hall of Famer and former NFL player Joe Theismann is 71. Rock musician John McPhee, the Doobie Brothers, is 70. Actor Hugh Grant is 60. Country singer-songwriter Hunter Hayes is 29.
This is the Opinion Page. This column is entitled "Pay Attention to President Trump's Real Successes" by Hugh Hewitt, special to the Washington Post. Sometimes there is a split-screen moment that perfectly encapsulates the country's divisions. We witnessed this Friday when Beltway and media elites were consumed with chasing yet another story about President Donald Trump, one from a fine reporter, but still resting entirely on anonymous sources. Meanwhile, they once again ignored, or failed to grasp, another significant foreign policy achievement by the Trump administration. Trump presided over a very important set of handshakes Friday. Judging how important requires memory. I visited Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo in 2009 at the invitation of the California National Guard, only a few weeks after then-Vice President Biden. We were assigned the same room. Not plush, nothing at Bondsteel is plush, but the tour of the border, the heavily armed crossings, the burned-out villages, was eye-opening. Joe Biden must know what these accords mean. Watch his 2009 speech at Bondsteel. He understands how deep the ancient hatreds run in this region. To have Kosovo and Serbia normalize economic relations is a big deal in itself, but both countries agreed to take steps to support the momentum for peace in the Middle East generated by the peace treaty between the United Arab Emirates and Israel. National Security Officer Robert C. O'Brien and Senior Advisor Jared Kushner had traveled to Israel to make a historic first direct flight from Tel Aviv to Abu Dhabi. While Kushner continued on to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, O'Brien split off to join the President and Richard Grenell, former ambassador to Germany, in the final negotiations between Kosovo and Serbia. It paid off. Serbia agreed to move its embassy to Jerusalem, and Kosovo, a majority Muslim nation, said it would establish ties with Israel. More dominoes were falling toward peace. Another may follow soon. So when Grenell teed off on a seemingly disinterested media, his frustration was understandable and helps explain Trump's rise and continuing appeal. Elites in the country, represented by those reporters, have power to shape narratives, but not necessarily the wisdom to choose the important ones. Thus, on Friday, reporters were chasing a story by The Atlantic's Jeff Goldberg that alleges the president, on a trip to France in 2018, said horrible things about the service members buried in the American cemeteries outside of Paris. On Friday morning, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who has spent more time around the president than any other senior official, denied ever hearing the president defame service members living or dead. On that trip or other, and former Press Secretary Sarah Sanders and former National Security Advisor John Bolton did so by the afternoon, which is a hat trick of people traveling with the president. Meanwhile, the media all but ignored the immense significance of the Kosovo-Serbia agreement, two countries whose enmity has required tens of thousands of Americans over two decades to spend years away from their families to prevent savage killing. Astonishing. The endless attempts to get Trump are now concisely, persuasively packaged by veteran journalist Byron York in his new book, Obsession, Inside the Washington Establishment's Never-Ending War on Trump. It's a riveting, careful look back at the war on Trump. The Atlantic story is just another chapter for the paperback edition of York's book. The electorate is wary of this anti-Trump alarmism. The decision on the minds of the undecided. Who is going to keep the economy recovering after the coronavirus? Who is going to contain China? Who is going to make the country better for kids and grandkids? In the minds of Trump supporters, it is not the Beltway's dug-in Mandarins. Many of Trump's supporters see these folks as bad people, not professionals. If you watched Game of Thrones, especially if you read the George R.R. Martin books, you'll recall the elites of cities along Slaver's Bay. The heroine of the long story, Daenerys Targaryen, conquers three different strongholds of bad guys in her march to the end game of battle with the biggest villain. As any good storyteller does, Martin makes his heroes mostly good with some flaws and her enemies all bad. That's not the way in our real world. But in U.S. politics in 2020, each side views the other in the stark terms of a fantasy epic. Both sides think they are dangerous, battling evil. The reality of diplomatic breakthroughs or of threats like the vast military buildup overseen by the Chinese Communist Party are all but ignored in the scramble to make everything fit the miniseries. The electorate will decide. They can vote for another 4 years of the Trump reset. That's the central question in the minds of many. Keep shaking everything up or settle down. Trump's not going to change, so when the final result arrives, there won't be any doubting the message it sends. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Process of Renaming Lehigh Hasn't Put Midland First, by Stuart Doreen. I have lived in Midland for more than 25 years and wondered often how Odessa nailed the naming of its second high school with Permian. And Midland responded with Robert E. Lee. It was Midland, not Odessa, that became the energy center of West Texas. It was Midland where buildings rose out of the ground as a response to the great industry that would pay the bills for a city, region, and state. After all, had it not been for oil, it is hard to figure that Midland would have been much different than Big Spring. We turned a blind eye to that history in 1961, and it appears we are about to do so again. The renaming saga has not been Midland's finest moment. By all indications, both sides and their social media followers have dug in so deep that they can't see an incredible opportunity to honor our city's rich oil history. Santa Rita High School, Discovery High, or Energy City High. Yes, there were possibilities to honor that wildcatter spirit. In fact, a wildcatter mascot seems most appropriate when thinking about a mascot for a high school inside the epicenter of one of the world's great oil basins. But no, in the end, the renaming process was about making a point. One side was determined to call out the perceived racism of the community's past, while the other, equally as headstrong, wasn't going to stop without making sure you couldn't spell out Midland Second School without L-E-E. It was a conflict equal to anything saw on Midland Memorial Stadium or the Scarborough Sports Complex. The renaming committee's final five naming options showed us which side had the votes. Three names include Lee. Oddly, none of them were Midlandy, which people repeatedly have stated is what they call Robert E. Lee High School. We have the San Antonio option, Legacy of Equality and Excellence. There's also Midland Carver Lee, the especially awkward combination of two high school names. Doesn't Carver and Lee High School of Midland come across better? Lastly, there was Lee High School, without the Midland. No Midland Lee. Of course, few people actually put Midland first in this conversation, so it shouldn't be unexpected that the actions missed the mark here. Our community fell a distant second to agendas. While it was honorable to fill the committee with Lee graduates, notable past and present Lee officials and current students, what we all fail to recognize is that this school matters to the entire community, not just Westsiders. We're all Midlanders first, right? Tyler ISD, when it changed its Lee High School, made sure Tyler was represented in the new name, Tyler Legacy High School. Committee members, if you really seek to put Midland first, then make sure we don't settle with a Lee all by itself. As for Tall City High School and Basin High School, one is outdated and the other is hardly specific about a city that has separated itself from every other community in the region. But as I stated earlier, coming up with a name that put Midland first was never a priority for many in this process. The committee still has time to change that. This column is entitled Renew Pandemic Jobless Benefits Now by Noah Smith, Bloomberg. The extra unemployment insurance benefits that were handed out by the U.S. government in the early months of the pandemic to people rendered jobless by COVID-19 represent one of the most extraordinary and successful programs in the nation's history. The $600 a week in assistance, often referred to as pandemic UI, was so generous that it caused an unprecedented spike in Americans' disposable income. Despite a huge rise in unemployment, the poverty rate actually fell thanks to these benefits. Most Americans are still able to pay their rent, holding off a much feared wave of evictions. And amazingly, pandemic UI managed to accomplish this without keeping Americans out of the workforce. One might think that paying people $600 per week not to work would result in a lot of people choosing to collect benefits instead of looking for new jobs, or even to quit their existing jobs, if they could credibly claim that they did so for pandemic-related reasons. But in fact, this didn't happen. Job vacancies fell. Wages remained stagnant or even fell, suggesting that employees weren't having a hard time trying to lure workers out of their homes. Economists generally agree that low labor demand from employers rather than low labor supply from workers is the biggest driver of high unemployment. Unfortunately, this remarkable program has expired. President Donald Trump issued a bizarre and possibly illegal executive order demanding that states continue the benefits at a significantly reduced level with funding from the Federal Emergency Management Agency budget. But many states are not following the order, and FEMA has only $44 billion to spend on this program. Meanwhile, Congress, due back in session this month, has failed to extend the pandemic UI program in any form, as lawmakers and the Trump administration remain at odds over new relief measures. This is going to put the livelihoods and well-being of millions of Americans in danger, and it threatens to blunt the strength of any economic recovery. Why hold back? Some will argue that this is inevitable. Pandemic UI has to end sometime after all. Presumably, as the economy recovers, normal market forces will come back into play, and paying people $600 a week not to work will begin to have a depressing effect on employment. But exactly when will that moment come? In order to answer that question, we need to understand why pandemic UI hasn't kept workers from trying to join the labor force. And that requires economic theory. The first reason is that jobs are hard to find. Many workers will probably choose to stay in their jobs or get new ones, even if pandemic UI would be slightly more lucrative for a few months. Some employers have offered laid-off workers the chance to be temporarily unemployed and collect pandemic UI and then come back to their jobs after the economy recovers. But these guarantees are probably unreliable in practice. Second, many workers are paid based on how long they've been at a company. If a worker leaves their job to take pandemic UI and then finds a new job later, they'll have to take a big and long-lasting hit to their wages. For the vast majority of workers, these risks and costs simply aren't worth it, even if the benefit is a bit higher than their current wage. It's important to note that all of these calculations rely on pandemic UI being limited in time. They're basically variations on the idea that a few months of cash isn't worth the risking a spell of unemployment. Workers always knew that pandemic UI would run out. Indeed, it did run out once already. So what does that imply for a renewal of the program? Assuming it was also temporary, workers' calculations would presumably be the same as the first time, and few would choose to leave work or remain unemployed. And since the pandemic will eventually end,
most likely from a vaccine that may expect to be widely available in early 2021, there will be every reason to think another bout of pandemic UI would be temporary. The only danger would come if workers concluded that a renewal of the program has heavy implications for future policy, that some degree of higher and long-lasting unemployment benefits would be permanent. That could induce a few low-wage workers on the margins to decide that they could afford to go on unemployment for a very long spell. But this seems unlikely. Workers know about the fickleness of U.S. government programs, and the first pandemic UI cutoff should reinforce that understanding. Furthermore, they know about the fiscal costs of the program and the near certainty that there will be political pressure for some form of austerity in the future. In other words, a second round of pandemic UI has little danger of causing a big rise in unemployment. Congress should act to renew this successful program before millions of American workers get hurt.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, September 9th. UTPB students answer the call. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. In a socially distanced mask-wearing ceremony, about 50 volunteer deputy registrars were sworn in outside the University of Texas Permian Basin Library Tuesday. The freshmen and sophomores are part of the UTPB Honors Program, led by Associate Professor of Art Chris Stanley and Associate Professor of Political Science Robert Perry. Amanda Snyder, Bilingual and Voter Outreach Coordinator for the Ector County Elections Office, conducted the ceremony. Stanley said the students will mainly be on campus helping register people to vote, but there are other events as well. For instance, a drive-through voter registration is scheduled from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday at Bowie Middle School, 500 West 21st Street. The Deputy Voter Registrar venture started when State Representative Brooks Landgraf, a Republican from Odessa, was invited to class to talk about issues involving his newly elected position. Quote, "We had asked Representative Landgraf what he thought the one thing we could do to help bring the kids into representative democracy. What's the one thing that we could do to help the citizens of his district, but then also the idea of teaching students about how government works?" So Brooks looked right at us. He didn't even miss a beat. He said, "Register voters," end quote. Stanley said, "We thought that was pretty admirable because you hear all these rumors about people not wanting people to be registering voters. We undertook this project, and I think it's going back now 5 or 6 years. The project has evolved, so our relationship with the elections office to help provide support for election events," end quote. The way Stanley sees it, the students serve the elections office, but they also go through training, learn about voting security, and how democracy and the process of casting ballots works. Quote, "The idea is we could lecture at them, and that tends to be the traditional norm. But this is the honors program, so we want them to actually have that experimental learning, high-impact learning, that brings them into the process. This is the beginning of a greater future, I think, for all of them," Stanley said. Snyder talked to the class via computer one morning, and students did much of their pre-training online. Sophomores took the oath last year, but they are still registered, so they are retaking the oath as a sign of support, Stanley said. Quote, "I think they're really seeing some of the challenges of voting and registering voters because we have voter apathy. This is a presidential election year. The thing to solidify, because I think there's a lot of criticism about higher education being to the left or the right, depending on where you are, is that for this project they are right down the middle. They can personally have sides, but as deputy voter registrars, they are right there in the big middle, and they're there to assist anyone who needs voter registration help," Stanley said. Sophomores Quade Cresswell, Samir Anwar, and Crystal Smith have been through the ceremony before. All three thought there was more interest in the election this year because it is a presidential year. Quote, but also, there's just been so much drama here politically that people may want something to change or something to stay the same, Creswell said. Smith said she wants to impact the community, make a difference, and help people fulfill their civic duty. Smith said she thinks it will be easier to register people this year because the election is so pervasive. Quote, it's all over the media, and people want their opinions to be heard, and they want to make a change, Smith said. Freshman Stephen Motz, Cadence Orbison, and Abigail Plunkett said they don't really know what to expect from the public when signing them up, but they think it's meaningful and it could be fun. Quote, I think that the local voting is very important because that really affects your daily life, so I think that's the most important aspect of voting, Mott said. Orbison says she originally got involved in the project because of a grade, but, quote, it is interesting seeing how it works, end quote. Orbison said Generation Z, of which he is part, is influential politically, but it's hard to get them to the polls because they don't feel their voice matters. Quote, so it's a lot of getting them to work and to actually go vote instead of protesting, she said. Plunkett said it's important for people, especially college students, to get involved and get registered, quote, because I think every vote is important. I definitely think that younger people should vote more and get their opinion in there, Plunkett said. Perry says he thinks students might be surprised by how much antipathy there is among people they try to register. Quote, sometimes there's just downright hostility. People just don't want to vote, don't want to be asked about it, get really nervous about it, and so forth. That surprises students, Perry said. Perry added that he's not sure why people react that way sometimes. They might see it as a government intrusion, he said. Quote, you don't have a right to know whether I can vote or not. We've had several people use expletives, not the ones doing the registration, Perry said. Despite any difficulties the students may face, Perry said he thinks they will remember this for the rest of their lives. Snyder said the turnout for the swearing-in ceremony was amazing. Quote, it's good to see how these young students are wanting to learn and participate in how our democracy works. This is the first step getting deputized and getting people out there to get them registered. Being a VDR, Voluntary Deputy Registrar, helps the election office a lot because they're in the forefront. They also get to do voter registration drives. They can go door to door, Snyder said. Early voting, October 13th, runs through October 30th, which is longer than usual because of the pandemic. Quote, we are doing the social distancing, but they are not mandated to wear masks. We recommend that they do, but we cannot enforce it. That's something that comes from the Secretary of State's office, Snyder said. She is predicting a really good turnout this year. Quote, we've already had a good turnout in new applicants. We've had people that are just now registering to vote that have never voted in their lives, and they're like in their 70s, Snyder said. She added that she has helped a couple of them fill out the forms. Just for Election Day, Snyder said she's going to be hiring almost 200 people. Quote, so if anyone is interested, they can give me a call and just ask for Amanda, she said. The number for the elections office is area code 432-498-4030. Because of the pandemic, Snyder said she is hiring an additional 56 people to keep things sanitized and make sure people keep their social distance. American Tribute begins this week. Organizers urge social distancing during Memorial. 19 years after 9/11, a display at Memorial Gardens Park will continue to memorialize the victims and celebrate Odessa's first responders. This year's event is slightly different than the previous American Tribute events put on by Prosperity Bank and Odessa's Parks and Recreation Department. Each September, 3,000 American flags are placed around the pond for nearly 2 weeks. Local police agencies lay wreaths in remembrance of fallen officers. This year's event is slightly different, with just parks employees handling the majority of the flag placement instead of volunteers due to social distancing. There will not be a public ceremony as in years past, but the Odessa Police Department will place a wreath on Thursday during a private ceremony. Steve Patton, Odessa's Parks and Recreation Director, said the annual event is both popular and important as it pays tribute to the lives lost on September 11th and to area first responders who have died in the line of duty. Patton hopes Odessans will mask up and walk the park to enjoy the flags between Thursday and September 21st. COVID-19 has presented a number of problems for large-scale events like the American Tribute. Patton said other Odessa events have been canceled, like the Fall Festival in October and holiday parade that is typically the first week of December. Patton said he hopes Odessans will still come out for another large-scale event, but stay in their cars. The Starbright Village is a holiday lights event at McKinney Park that boasts millions of lights and that Odessans typically either stroll through or drive through. Patton said this year it will be drive-through unless something changes with the pandemic between now and December. He promises big things for the event that draws visitors from around West Texas. He said the Parks Department will also decorate Memorial Gardens Park this year, as well as Grant Avenue between 2nd and 8th again. He said dropping the Fall Festival will give them extra time to create the Starbright Village and that a new Tunnel of Crystals will be something that Odessans won't want to miss. He said American Tribute is again sponsored by Prosperity Bank, and the holiday decorations at Memorial Gardens Park will be sponsored by Southwest Bank. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,382. Ector County negative, 19,974, out of 24,679 tested, with 323 pending, 76 deaths. Recovered, 3,662. Active cases, 644. Midland County, 3,362 confirmed cases and 74 deaths. Texas, 641,791 confirmed cases with 5,339,126 tested. Total Texas deaths, 13,553. U.S. cases, 6,509,590 total confirmed cases and 193,938 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Vote for Best of the Basin. Voting for the Odessa American's annual Best of the Basin is coming to an end at 6 p.m. today. This year's online ballot features more than 210 categories for West Texans to cast winners. Winners will be announced in a special section October 25th, with overall champions and runners-up being recognized. To vote, visit www.thebestofthepermianbasin.com. Benefit Concert. Oilfield Helping Hands has scheduled its second annual Permian Black Gold Bash Benefit Concert featuring Phil Hamilton and Kevin Fowler today at the Rolling Sevens Ranch, 11,700 West County Road 122. Doors open at 6 p.m. VIP dinner with the Hamiltons and sponsorship is available. To purchase a table or for more information, visit oilfieldhelpinghands.org or tinyurl.com/Y4ZAAZ8C or contact Katie Grimes at katie.grimes@oilfieldhelpinghands.org or call area code 512-635-2331. Bustin' for Badges. Bustin' for Badges is scheduled for Thursday and Friday at Windwalker Farms in Stanton. This event benefits local law enforcement, Odessa Police Department, Midland Police Department, Ector County Sheriff's Office, and Midland County Sheriff's Office, and helps pay for much-needed equipment and supplies. Raffle tickets are currently available for a Polaris Ranger 570, a $10,500 value, a Springfield M1A rifle, an $1,800 value, and a Diamond VIP package for a George Strait concert, a $3,400 value, which has been postponed until further advised. The raffle tickets can be purchased by coming to the Odessa Police Department front desk during regular business hours or by calling 335-3322. Raffle tickets are $20 each or 6 tickets for $100. To register for Bustin' for Badges or for more information, call 571-3462 or visit bustinforbadges.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. Section A, County's new HR head named. Penwell Solar Project's tax abatement postponed again. Ector County Commissioners Tuesday announced the hiring of Donna James of Odessa, former Human Resources HR Director at the Reeves County Detention Center at Pecos, to succeed the retiring County Human Resources Director, Patricia Patton. Precinct 3 Commissioner Dale Childers said after the 10 a.m. meeting that he had found James' work at the private prison persuasive because it will be directly applicable to her responsibilities in the county, adding that she has also had considerable experience in the Permian Basin energy industry. James' salary will be about $81,000 per year. In a matter held over from last month, the court, on a 4-1 vote, tabled until after the new fiscal year starts October 1st, a solar company's request for a 100% property tax abatement for 5 years and a 50% abatement for the next 5 years. Precinct 1 Commissioner Eddie Shelton voted no, indicating that he preferred to approve the abatement immediately. Odessa Chamber of Commerce Development Director Wesley Burnett submitted a resolution from Grow Odessa supporting Origis Energy, whose Director of Development, Matthew Gomez of Lakeway, said the proposed Rockhound Solar Project would involve the installation of $600 million in solar panels by 600 construction workers. The project would be south of I-20 near Penwell. Childers said Gomez had been consulting privately with Judge Debbie Hayes and Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons about the county's involvement, which may entail an upfront payment by the company to help offset the loss of tax revenues. Gomez had been asked to return when the matter was tabled August 25th, and he said Tuesday that he would willingly make the 720-mile round trip from near Austin again for the court's regular October 12th meeting. In other business, the commissioners approved interlocal cooperation agreements with Burnett and Hudspeth counties for the possible future housing of jail inmates. However, Sheriff Mike Griffiths said the agreements are a contingency that will probably not be needed. Griffiths said the local jail's population was reduced by the transfer of 22 women inmates to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice 2 weeks ago, and that it will be further relieved by the transfer of 44 men September 17th. Referring to the state prison system, which had been restricting its numbers in an effort to control COVID-19, Griffiths said they're picking up on their intake. Burnett County is in central Texas near Austin, and Hudspeth County is in far west Texas near El Paso. Attorneys Blue Hyatt and Paul Baxter of the Lynch Chapel and Alsop firm in Midland appeared in their advocacy of a plan by Odessa Holdings Development to build a 21-acre manufactured housing and residential construction development at 4200 West University Boulevard, saying the project should go forward despite the opposition of Occidental Petroleum Corporation. To stop us at this point would be unjust, Hyatt said. Three Oxy representatives who declined to identify themselves took the podium to say the development would represent a safety hazard because they have a pipeline in the area. After County Attorney Dusty Gallivan said the court had no reason to deny the permit, the commissioners unanimously okayed it, with Shelton saying, "It's not our fight." The commissioners also accepted $6,514 from the Bridge United Methodist Church for the sheriff's office, heard a proposal from George Long to expedite approval from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality for his establishment of a scrap tire processing plant at 16,168 West 35th. Approved an $86,225 contract with the Systech company to upgrade the door control panel at the detention center. Okayed a 5-year copier lease contract with CMC Business Systems. Allocated $7,375 to the cemetery fund for equipment. Approved a $450 expenditure by the county judge's office for office supplies. Transferred $9,500 from the employee health claims budget to self-funded health services for vision insurance. Okayed a $5,000 budget amendment for contract services at the sheriff's office. Woman charged with assaulting elderly woman. A 19-year-old woman was arrested after she reportedly assaulted an 82-year-old woman. Monique Garcia, 19, was charged with injury to the elderly, a third-degree felony. The reported assault happened at 6:20 p.m. Wednesday in the 10,000 block of West University, an Ector County Sheriff's Office affidavit detailed. Loretta Taylor, 82, reportedly told deputies that Garcia was demanding she allow her to return to her RV after leaving the property. Taylor stated Garcia began swinging at her. Garcia reportedly struck Taylor on the right side of her face, right bicep, and right leg. Taylor stated Garcia had caused her physical pain, the affidavit stated. Deputies saw several cuts on her right bicep and right leg. Garcia was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. She had one bond totaling $10,000 and posted bail Friday, jail records show.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.